Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
The spiraling effects of Syria's civil war have been top news this summer, with tens of thousands of desperate Syrians fleeing the unending violence and many seeking refuge in Europe. But what about the United States? Last week, President Obama said the U.S. would take at least 10,000 displaced Syrians, and presumably those refugees would be settled like others have been. The State Department and the placement agencies collaborate on communities they deem suitable, including cities like Lewiston, Maine, Worcester, Mass., and Manchester, New Hampshire. But while every resettlement process has its challenges, with this war, the refugee question has an added layer of difficulty. Fears about national security. Some U.S. politicians are concerned that this group could include those with terrorist ambitions. Today in The Exchange, responding to the Syrian refugee crisis in our country and in our region. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us by phone is Anita Fabos. She's an associate professor of international development and social change at Clark University in Worcester. Her research is focused on refugees and forced migrants, especially in the Middle East. And Anita Fabos, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us in studio, Nadia Alawa, founder and president of New Day Syria, a local nonprofit that focuses on empowerment and help to Syria's mothers and children. Nadia is Syrian-American with Danish roots as well. And Nadia, it's really good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Amy Marshallden, Director of Services for New Americans at Accentria Care Alliance in Concord, which is one of New Hampshire's major refugee resettlement agencies. And Amy Marshallden, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Amy, I want to start with you since you've been in this business for some time. What are you hearing right now about the possibility of Syrian refugees coming to New Hampshire?
Certainly, with the growing crisis, we are all wondering what the U.S. response is going to be. We know in New Hampshire that we are considered a third-tier state for resettlement of Syrians, meaning that other states, once processing of Syrian refugees becomes active, other states would be slated to take Syrians before New Hampshire, simply because they have pre-existing Syrian communities in the U.S.
Tier 3. So that doesn't necessarily mean New Hampshire's a bad place. It just means that people tend to have less ties here.
That's correct.
Have we been tier 1 for other groups of refugees?
It may not have been described that way, but we certainly have been a major resettlement site for Bhutanese refugees. I think close to 8,000 Bhutanese refugees have been resettled over the last 7 years.
Well, and as I said earlier last week, President Obama said, okay, thank you to Europe for taking in so many folks, especially Germany. And people kept saying, what about the U.S.? Here's what President Obama's press person, Josh Earnest, said about the U.S. response to this refugee crisis in Syria.
This year that will end, the fiscal year that will end at the end of this month, the United States is on track to take in about 1,500 Syrian refugees. The president has directed his team to scale up that number next year, and he's informed his team that he would like them to accept at least make preparations to accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in the next fiscal year. The United States will continue to use our influence to encourage other countries, both in the region and around the world, even countries who are not traditional donors to those kinds of efforts, to ramp up their participation.
Again, that's Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, in a briefing on Thursday about the U.S. response to the refugee crisis. Nadia, what's your reaction to this at least 10,000 number?
First of all, the real issue here is not about how many refugees we're going to be taking in the U.S. or in Europe or in the different countries. The real issue really is we need to stop the refugee exodus. We need to stop what's going on inside Syria. We're taking actions against Assad. That said, 10,000 refugees to the U.S., it is still such a small number that it doesn't really make sense overall. You have in Turkey 2 million refugees sitting, and already in Europe we have almost 500,000 that have entered at this point in time. So 10,000 refugees to the U.S. over a period of 5 years, that is actually the numbers that they are talking, does not really make sense.
So 2 million in Turkey, Nadia, 500,000 in Europe are on their way. Lebanon also, Jordan, other places that are holding
refugees
now. Yeah, these
countries, they are also countries with very weak financial with very weak financial situation, and they have taken in all these refugees. The refugees are sitting in very bad circumstances. New Day Syria works in Turkey, where, of course, refugees there have a much better living situation. And at the same time, then they are guests. They don't have any legal rights. And after you've been sitting as a guest with no legal rights and you cannot feed your children after a few years, it does get very tiring. And undignified.
Again, the phone number for you to join us here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Professor Favos, to you too, lots of back and forth on this number from what I have read. You know, there's Josh Earnest saying, hey, 10,000. But other people are saying that's a drop in the bucket compared to the numbers. How do nations figure out who's right and who's responsible? What's some of the push-pull there, Professor Favos?
Well, one of the important issues to keep in mind is that the U.S. is part of a global refugee humanitarian system. And this system is designed, or it should have been designed since World War II, to accommodate and take care of and manage the flows of people from conflict and war. And I think what we're seeing in the United States is we have a number of other refugee communities as well. Iraqis have been coming in large numbers, and prior to that, Somalis, Congolese, and refugees from other parts of the world where there have been conflicts. But I share Nadia's perspective that a figure of 10,000 is quite small, considering the urgent need and considering also the previous humanitarian efforts of the United States to resettle other refugee communities.
And what do you think, Professor Favos, also about the point that Nadia has made and that others have made, that instead of focusing so much on this refugee crisis, we should focus more of our attentions on just stopping the violence that is causing people to leave in the first place?
Right. I do agree with that. The wars that are going on in the Middle East and the fallout from the great instability from the Arab Spring have roiled the region in a great deal of insecurity for the people there. So I would say that most people do not want to leave home. Most people are not looking to become refugees, and they would prefer to be able to stay in their home countries. So that would be the first order of business, I think.
Well, and Nadia, your work right now is in the region, right? Helping women and children in Syria, in some of those bordering countries. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. I just came back, actually, from a trip to Antakya, which is right at the border in Turkey to Syria. And we met mothers who also had recently arrived from Syria. They just could not take the shellings anymore that was going on, that was happening ongoing relentlessly by the Assad regime. People, they are sitting there and they still want to go back. You have all these hundreds of thousands of mothers with their children and they want to go back. They are just trying to wait this out. So definitely people really do not want to leave Syria. A lot of the people that you have arriving in Europe are by default some of the wealthier refugees, if you can call them that, who can afford to actually pay smugglers, get into those unsafe dinghy boats, and then, you know, in many cases end up drowning or watching their young ones drown. And then they end up in Europe having endured who knows what for several years, having gone from inside Syria to different places. And then they arrive in Europe and are treated worse than animals. And this is human dignity. What happened to humanity? It's actually unbelievable right now, the issues that are, and the outlashes that are taking place in Europe right now. Of course, you have some good guys such as Germany, Sweden, and some other Scandinavian countries and a few countries here and there who take in refugees. But what about the rest? What about what's happening right now in Greece, in Serbia, Macedonia?
Hungary.
Hungary. It's so unbelievable.
Help us clear this up, Nadia. So you're sort of working right now with people on the border. You're saying a lot of people don't want to be refugees. Are they just kind of waiting it out and hoping to be able to go back once it's
safe? Well, you can only take so much shelling. One thing is that there's shelling going on, and as the shelling happens, you have ISIS moving in also, clearing out spaces, because Syrians, they're moderate people. They don't want to be under the grip of ISIS. So these families then move again. We have what we do in Turkey, as our organization, is that we want to empower the women, earn a living, take care of their children so that they don't feel the need that they have to leave. Just having people leave, and then eventually when they get to Europe, the chances of them returning to their home country obviously gets lower and lower
the further away you get
and the more services that you get, where you can start working, you know, professionally.
You know, that's a tough decision, Amy, and I know you've worked with a lot of refugees from other conflicts. What's the tipping point for folks where they sort of say, okay, this is way too dangerous for me right here, so I'm going to go right next door and wait it out? Or I'm going to take that journey to Europe. I'm going to try and get refugee status and come to the United States. What's the sort of emotional decision-making process that people go through there?
You know, sometimes I don't think people have a lot of time to think about it. They're fleeing for their lives. They're running from danger. They're running from certain death. And it's desperation. People who have fled to other countries, who... The average length of stay in refugee camps is now currently upwards of 20 years.
20 years.
And so
the
ability to get resettled for some refugees is really the only option that they have.
Again, our phone number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're getting Granite State reaction to the refugee crisis that we are seeing in Syria, in the Middle East, spreading to Europe. And now President Obama says the U.S. should take more Syrian refugees as well. 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of this from a New Hampshire perspective? Do you think the United States should take in more refugees from Syria as this crisis grows? The Exchange number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. All of you, first up is Fred in Nashua. Hi, Fred. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes. I believe that the United States carries a great deal of guilt and responsibility for what happened in the Middle East with the policies under George Bush and then later on Obama. And it needs to take in about 1 million refugees.
So we bear some guilt for the region, Fred, so we should take in 1 million refugees.
Not just some, a great deal, probably the greatest amount of guilt.
Thank you for
America created ISIS with its foreign policy in the Middle East.
Fred, thank you for calling in. And Anita, without, you know, assigning blame to who created ISIS, I think it's a little more complicated than Fred says. But what do you think about this, taking in 1 million refugees? How would that change the equation?
Well, I do think that there's a historical precedent for the United States resettling big groups of refugees. If we look back to the Indochina refugee crisis, which has some similarities to what we're seeing today with people fleeing from their nations of Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia in rickety boats and taking refuge in in nearby countries, the United States resettled 1.2 million of these Indochinese refugees over the period of about 20 years. So it was a longer period of time, but the United States, of course, did feel some responsibility because of the events of the Vietnam War. And prior to that, I think 40,000 Hungarians were resettled in the United States from camps in Europe as well. So there are historical precedents. I'm interested to hear more from Amy about the state of sort of funding and support for the refugee resettlement process now. I think it's a little bit more stressed for funds, but certainly the United States has in its history made a big impact on resettlement.
Well, and Fred, here's an email from Tricia, who feels the same way you do. She says, along with immediate steps, we should be focused on how to prevent such crises from ever happening in the first place. Tricia says, our U.S. policymakers bear a huge responsibility for this situation because of our over-reliance on military action as a foreign policy tool. Tricia says, we bombed and invaded Iraq, and it's currently a failed state. We bombed Libya. It's a mess. We've supplied military equipment to a ragtag bunch of competing groups in Syria, deceivingly labeled the Syrian opposition, and much of that equipment has ended up in the hands of ISIS. Tricia says, we have to stop and recognize our part in creating this immense suffering. Tricia, thank you for the email. And Fred, thank you for the call. Do you want to jump in there, Nadia?
Yeah, I do have a comment about ISIS. When the Syrian revolution and the current humanitarian crisis started in 2011, all of us on the outside, the Syrians on the inside, all knew that unless something happened radically, extremist groups would go in and take over inside Syria, and they would go in and they would start collaborating with Assad, which is what we are all convinced that they're doing. It's all a matter of oil and power and money and splitting the country. We do believe that ISIS is a creation. It is not Syrians standing up and becoming suddenly very extremist. Syrians are historically very moderate people. Most of the people in ISIS are not Syrians unless they are recruited under force. So that is something to consider. Who are the people in ISIS? Where did they come from? And how come today in New York Times we are reading an article where it clearly states, and everybody can do their own research, that Putin has been helping facilitate Chechen fighters getting into Syria and joining ISIS so he could get rid of them. People inside Syria from the beginning, from the start of the revolution, would describe the people who will come and kill them, slaughter them with knives, as Russian-speaking people. So Russia has been in Syria, Iranians have been in Syria, other people from other countries have been in Syria under the disguise of being ISIS.
So the country, really, you're saying, Nadia, has been taken over by others who have other political interests. So
initially, there was a very close collaboration with Assad, and since then ISIS got created. So you still have foreign fighters with Assad, and you also have ISIS. But if you go inside, God be with you, and you do a demographic poll, I'm sure that you will not find a lot of Syrians are actually in ISIS.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A couple Facebook comments for you. And then when we come back, we'll talk more about refugee resettlement in this country and in New Hampshire, how that's worked, how it might work in the future. On Facebook, Zachariah says the images are heartbreaking. The stories are unimaginable. He says we have the overwhelming capacity to assist in placing these refugees, and we should. Beverly Ann says these children need a chance in life without suffering. Teach them well. They are our future ambassadors. We must act with mercy and faith. How many abandoned shelters do we have here in the United States? How many veterans looking for work? Let's use our resources wisely. And on that issue of resources, Michael says on Facebook, who is going to pay for their care? We'll talk about that and a lot more after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post your comments on Facebook like those folks did. Find us on Twitter, and we'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Syrian refugee crisis and whether the U.S. and New Hampshire should take in more Syrians as refugees. What do you think? We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Amy Marshalden, Anita Fabos, Nadia Alawa, let's go right back to our listeners. And Jeff is joining us from Bedford. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. I travel quite a bit for work. In fact, I'm calling here from California right now. I travel through the Manchester airport, and I do see the Bhutanese refugees coming in. I just wonder what programs exist to help them integrate into the culture and into the communities once they're here. I actually went to the UN website, and I couldn't find anything. So just wondering how we can all help once they're here in New Hampshire.
Okay. And Jeff, thank you for calling in from California. Good that you're a dedicated listener. Thank you very much. Amy, go ahead. That's for you.
Sure. In New Hampshire, we have two refugee resettlement programs, obviously Acentria Care Alliance and also International Institute. Both of our organizations are designed to help refugees get resettled and integrated into New Hampshire. We help with basic needs at the very beginning, help set up apartments. Everything that you and I have in our lives, we help refugees get connected with. So getting connected to healthcare, getting connected to the school system. For many adults who may not speak English, we offer classes and help them start learning the language. Most importantly, we help people find jobs, secure jobs, so that they can experience financial stability.
Yeah, and Anita, to you, walk us through how this works. Our caller mentioned the United Nations, but also the State Department plays a huge role. So just this designation as refugee is very specific and sometimes very difficult to get.
Sure. Well, I think it's probably clear to most people that the people that we're seeing now fleeing war and conflict are refugees in the sociological sense. They are running away and seeking sanctuary in wherever safe places they can find. Then there's a humanitarian system that actually applies international law to the people who are fleeing from these conflicts. And those individuals who cross a border are technically then able to be considered, an international border, I should say, are technically considered by international law to be refugees. So in that, once becoming a sociological refugee, once they cross the border, they have access to the protection of the international community. And this protection offers them the relief from being deported back to their home country. It sometimes includes humanitarian support, but really it offers the legal protection of sanctuary in a state that has signed the international conventions. And one of the points that your guest Nadia made earlier is that many of the countries where Syrians are now are not, in fact, signatories to the international convention. So those refugees in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Jordan, don't have as firm protection from the possibility of being returned to a very unsafe place. But furthermore, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, your caller mentioned that he had looked at the UNHCR website. They are responsible in the countries where refugees seek, you know, a safe place. Once the designation of legal refugee is made, the United States then sends their State Department and Homeland Security folks to the places where these refugees are living. And a small, small minority of people, which the United States identifies as maybe being the most vulnerable and the most in need of extra support, those folks are then considered for resettlement. And so a process starts where people will be screened for security purposes and given all kinds of United States support to then travel to the United States where they are received received by the agencies like AMIs and like international institutes to start that stabilization process that she was describing.
Well, joining us now on the phone is someone from a community that has resettled more refugees than any other city in the state. We're talking with Pat Long, an alderman from the Queen City of Manchester. And Alderman Long, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate
it. Thank you, Laura. Well, my pleasure.
Well, this has been a big issue in Manchester for at least the past decade, maybe two. How do you react to the story that the U.S. may accept at least 10,000 refugees from the Syrian conflict?
Yeah, with respect to Manchester, I think the refugee settlements have been going very well. I mean, we have a strong base now. There's cultural groups that are setting up their own associations and caring for their own people, which is a great success and great help. I personally don't have an issue, and we've been the last couple of years getting between 115 and 125 or so. So it's not the 350, and with today's economy, I think we're fine.
With today's economy, in other words, is enough jobs and so forth available, Alderman
Long?
That's
correct.
Yeah.
There are. Yeah.
So if Manchester were chosen as a host city for a number of Syrian refugees, and Amy Marshallden said, by the way, that that's not necessarily the case, how would you feel about that?
I would not have an issue with that. I can't speak for the rest of the board.
Sure.
I wouldn't have an issue with that. You know, as long as we get a heads up, for our schools and for us to set up the infrastructure to receive them with open arms, then I don't have an issue with that.
What have you learned, Alderman Long, from Manchester's participation in welcoming refugees? It's been a long and sometimes bumpy process for you guys.
Well, it has. I learned that, with the Institute communicating regularly, and having somebody with respect to the school on a school board or with respect to the schools or in city government following up, making sure that things are going smoothly, that it really has not been an issue.
Okay. Alderman Long, any final thoughts from you on this idea of possibly Syrian refugees coming to New Hampshire, joining the refugee community in your city?
Well, my understanding is that they're looking for other communities also, and I would just suggest that they affirm that those other cities are welcoming, are welcoming cities.
So check that out first.
Check that out first. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Thank you very much. I know it's election day there in Manchester, so I'll let you go.
It is. Thank you.
Bye bye. That's Pat Long again, Alderman from the City of Manchester. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. Amy and Nadia, I'd love your thoughts. How about you first, Amy? Just responding to what Pat Long said about, making sure that a community is ready.
Over the years, resettlement agencies have really, stepped up their game to be in consultation with communities. We work very hard to be in touch with local government, with the school systems, with health clinics. And so it's really it's a conversation. When we do our abstracts and we look at our capacity, we want to make sure that those partners are involved because we want to make sure that we can do resettlement in a responsible way.
Yeah, go ahead, Nadia, your thoughts.
In terms of the Syrian refugees, I really think that the Syrian American community is more than ready and willing to open their arms and welcome them. I cannot tell you how many messages I've been getting daily for the past 2 weeks from people who want to help. And in particular, we have specific states such as Massachusetts, Florida, Illinois, and New Jersey, where the communities, they're informing me and they're informing other people. They're just ready. They're willing. They have everything ready. They just want the refugee families to start arriving. So traditionally, I think we would not have to worry about Syrians arriving here in terms of being received by the Syrian American community.
Again, the phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Wayne joins us from Dover. Hi, Wayne. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm concerned that some other countries who also have a dog in this fight aren't participating. Saudi Arabia, Russia, Japan, China. And the second point is the refugees that Europe took in the past, sometimes they don't repay their host countries in a manner that's correct.
When you say repay, what do you mean, Wayne?
By becoming productive, hardworking citizens. I'm not saying we should not allow people to have their culture, but when you turn around and you bite the hand that feeds you, which has been going on now for a number of years, and again, it's not all refugees that do it, but I think we have to be really careful about who we're taking in. And yes, are they Syrians, or are they Afghanis, or are they Iranians? It's a really tough situation, and I just want to make sure the government, before they start bringing people in wholeheartedly and giving them an opportunity, that we're not going to end up having them turning on us again.
So when you say bite the hand that feeds you, Wayne, do you mean like the Charlie Hebdo situation?
Yes.
Where people went in and, yeah.
Yes.
So concerns that people be vetted fully so that they don't present a security risk.
And also the, blaming the United States for all these problems. One of the problems is the population. There are too many people in the Middle East to be taken care of properly.
Okay.
I worked there 30 years ago, and the population has boomed. How do they provide for that number of people in an area that's mostly arid?
Well,
I mean,
and Wayne, I appreciate you the call, and I'm glad you called because the security concern has come up a lot, especially on the Republican side of the presidential campaign. Lindsey Graham talked about it at an event last week. Ben Carson talked about it on NPR recently. I want to play for you now a cut from Peter King. He's a New York Republican U.S. representative, former member of the Homeland Security Committee. Here he is talking about CNN, exactly about the concern that our caller Wayne raises.
When people talk about large numbers coming in, I don't see how we could possibly do that because we have no intelligence on the ground. There's no way of knowing without really extensive vetting and investigation who these people are, what their background is. I think one way we could do it is take maybe refugees that are already in Jordan, because Jordan does have very good intelligence, work with them and also with some of the relief organizations over there, and maybe take some of them to alleviate the pressure on Jordan. But it's going to be difficult, Wolf, and all I'm saying is let's keep our eyes open. I don't want to be on your show a year or two from now explaining why someone who came in under the guise of being a refugee was responsible for something like the Boston Marathon bombing or a subway attack in New York.
Again, that's New York Republican Representative Peter King, a member of the Homeland Security Committee, speaking on CNN about his security concerns around Syrian refugees. And this is, again, a concern that our caller Wayne raised. And I'd love to hear from everybody on this. And Amy, you first. Go ahead.
I think having security concerns is a very natural thing. What I would like to emphasize is that refugees are the most scrutinized travelers to the U.S. They go through very rigorous background checks at several different times throughout their refugee processing that takes place overseas. So they have face-to-face interviews with Department of Homeland Security staff. They go through name checks. They are fingerprinted. Those fingerprints are run through several different databases that include U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Pre-departure, they are checked one more time to make sure that there's not new information, and upon arrival, they are screened to make sure that the person traveling is actually the person who was screened for approval and admission into the United States.
So you think Europe has such a rigorous process, Amy? And I know you work here in New Hampshire, especially given the floods of people that are coming now. It's also fast. It's also big. Maybe I'll throw that question actually to Anita, and then Nadia, definitely hear from you too. But go ahead, Anita.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
The idea that, you know, there are security concerns expressed by many in the political arena, expressed by our caller. Amy's saying the system here in the United States for bringing refugees in is super, super tight, many multiple layers of checking. I wonder, Anita, if the process in Europe is as rigorous, especially now, given how quickly things are unfolding.
Right. I think that's a very interesting question because, as we saw from the Hungarian border crossing pictures and videos and the news that's coming from the groups of people who are coming over, clearly there's not a system of holding, you know, and rigorous checking and so forth. Like
Amy, though, I would say that refugees are one of the more vulnerable populations, and I would be doubtful that many of the people coming over are, in fact, coming with nefarious purposes. But I think one of the you know, I concur also that the borders that we see, that people are concerned about borders and border security. On the other hand, we are living right now in a very globalized world, and for better or worse, our populations are very fluid. There's a lot of mobility going on. I'm not sure that. I don't know what else to say about that.
Sure. And Nadia, your thoughts, too, on what our caller says and what we heard there from Representative Peter King. But to the point that you made earlier, that a lot of the people who are causing the trouble inside Syria, if I could put it that way, aren't Syrians.
They aren't Syrians. And also, if you are part of a terrorist group like ISIS, you don't need to officially be posing as a refugee to enter any one country in particular. There are other ways of you getting your paperwork done. How did they move from one country to another? The terrorists that we have experienced, they did not come as refugees to the U.S. or to countries in Europe. Excuse me. So I think that there's a little bit of homophobia involved in this, in the issue that we are, you know, speaking about right now. One thing is ISIS, another thing is refugees, another thing is people all over social media are mentioning that many of the refugees that are risking their lives and then arriving and humiliating themselves in Europe happen to be men and they don't have any families. Well, as we all saw 2 weeks ago, what happened to Alan and his young brother and their mother? They drowned while the father was swimming from one young child to the other, literally in front of his eyes. One boy drowned and then the other boy drowned. Keep that in mind when you start judging people and start wondering why fathers are preferring to leave their families behind in Turkey, not being able to provide for them or take care of them or know that they're doing fine, while they risk the trek across the sea into Europe, into who knows where, hoping they won't get arrested, hoping that they'll survive, get to a country where they then can settle down, apply for asylum, and then start a family reunion. It's a long process, and people are doing what they can. Even though, as Syrians, they don't want to leave their country, in the end, this is one person with one family, and they need to provide for their own family. And if they cannot stay in their country or in a neighboring country, they need to do what they have to do to provide for their own families.
Well, and I have seen that question raised just in local media recently. You know, why is it we're seeing all these young men, and that makes people feel suspicious? So you're saying that a lot of these families, Nadia, that you're hearing about, find sort of a spot where they can put the mom and the kids just outside, maybe in a refugee camp, and then the dad makes the dangerous trek to Europe
to
make
money. To put things
in
perspective, in Turkey, where these refugees that we're talking about coming to Europe are coming from, we have 2 million refugees and less than 10% are in refugee camps. So that's 1.8 million people that are living in any way that they can. Some try to find work, some they live however they live. So they're not. It's not like there's a camp system and people are sitting there and doing nothing. People are every day struggling to be able to feed their children. I met these families. I saw the children on the streets. I saw their mothers going to work from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., earning $40 to $50 a week while their children were outside taking care of themselves. Yeah.
Well, all right. We'll follow up after a short break. We have lots of time to finish up that point. Thank you for that call. We'll take more in just a moment. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the U.S. role in the Syrian refugee crisis. And you can join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Chris is in Putney, Vermont. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. I don't think I've been on this show.
Well, welcome then again.
You put together a wonderful program. I've been happy listening to it on the telephone waiting to get on. The first thing that I was going to say is that it's not our fault that Syria fell apart, and we shouldn't. We may have had a hand in Iraq falling apart, a small hand, yeah. But Syria, we didn't. And it's a complex situation. And I thank you very much for having Nadia on, who explained that these people are Chechens, and this explains our friends and our enemies, frenemies, that some people just follow different rules and will get rid of their problems by putting them in another country. So I wanted to say that. And the other thing is this dance between fear and love. Are we going to accept people that are real refugees? Or are we just going to put up barriers all the time? And many of the terrorists that came out of Europe were the children of people who emigrated years before. And so it's how we accept people into this country for the next generation that really has an important effect on how the United States fits in the world and how the world goes forward.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling. Amy, do you want to jump in on that?
Yes, I'd love to. I totally agree with the caller. I think it's so important once newcomers are here, refugees and immigrants, that we make sure that we have welcoming communities to receive them. What happened in France could be described as a marginalized group of people who did not feel integrated, that they did not feel that they were part of the community. And so it's so important in our work that we do make sure that we have a structure of welcome. In fact, this is National Welcome Week. There is a movement across America called Welcoming America. New Hampshire is a part of that. We have representation through Welcoming New Hampshire. And if you go to welcomingamerica.org, you can check out the links to all of the activities that are happening across the U.S. But in particular, there are several activities happening in New Hampshire this week.
All right, Chris, thank you for calling in. Next up is Alex in Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
My heart certainly goes out to all the refugees, and I'm hoping that New Hampshire can be very welcoming and do its fair share. My concern is a question. The presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, has publicly stated, I believe on the PBS NewsHour, that he supports ongoing airstrikes in Syria. And is that possibly contributing to the problem? Is that maybe not such a wise idea. Is that causing more refugees?
So American airstrikes in Syria, making even more danger. Now, I'm going to turn to you, Nadia, but again, you're more working with, you know, women and children on the ground, on the borders. But I wonder what you hear from people about that.
Yeah, so definitely my focus is the humanitarian aspect. But since, you know, the very first few months of the revolution in Syria that started because people, they wanted freedom, dignity and liberty, the same rights that we have here in the United States, which the Syrian people have not been getting under the Assad regime. Since the very start of the revolution, which now has turned into this horrible crisis, very quickly into it, people, they were requesting no-fly zones and that the international community, including the U.S., should stand up and help secure a no-fly zone. And the fact that shellings are still going on, you know, bombings by the Assad regime very close to the Turkish border up in the northern area of Syria where you don't have the Assad government controlling the area anymore, really speaks a lot about why people are still at this point in time just fleeing relentlessly. They just cannot take the shellings anymore. There are very few places where there are no shellings. And as we saw in August of 2013 with the chemical weapons attack in Muadamiya, where we were trespassing the red line, nothing really happened. So the Assad regime continues with chemical weapons and air shellings.
Okay. Well, Alex, thank you for the call. And here's an email from Wesley in Kittery, Maine. He says, there's only one way to stop the huge number of refugees around the world. We need to make the countries they live in more desirable to live in. If the country is safe and there are jobs, people will not want to leave. It means playing hardball with countries and forcing their hand on safety issues in their country education, and corruption, make these people's home countries safe, and they want to take pride in living there and make their country a better place to live. Wesley, thank you for the email. Anita Fabos, what do you think? Easier said than done when it comes to a place like Syria, but, you know, we appreciate the sentiment. If there weren't wars, mm-hmm. people wouldn't be fleeing so much.
That is true, and people make those calculations, don't they, when they're thinking about their lives going forward and the lives of their families, where is the safest place where they can pursue their, you know, everyday normal well-being. But I want to maybe take us back to the European context. So we've heard it said that this is the largest refugee crisis globally since the aftermath of World War II. And if we think about the kinds of investments, the Marshall Plan and so forth, that the United States made, for example, in European countries, we do see that it's not just, in my opinion, asking other countries to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and just provide a better life. I really do think that there's a role for the global community to play in helping to rebuild economies and devastated, war-torn societies so that people will want to return back home or will not want to leave in the first place.
And as Nadia, you said earlier, most Syrians that you talk to don't want to leave Syria.
No, they really don't want to leave, and they take a lot of pride in their country. And many of the families have moved very slowly throughout Syria, and then they have been at the border in Turkey just trying to wait this out. And then recently the ones who still had some money left, you know, a few thousand dollars left, they decided there's no future for us to stay in Turkey. We need to make the trek. For example, because he has been in the news, the father of the boy, the two boys that drowned, they spent basically 2.5 years before they made the trek. It wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment thing. Yes, we do have instances, many, many, many instances, where there's so many shellings and people, they just have to rush out of their homes. But usually they go from one place to another inside Syria. They don't...
It seems safer.
Yeah. Well, no, they don't want to leave their country.
Yeah.
They don't want to just go to Turkey, even though if the borders were open. They really want to stay inside their home country.
Sure. So they go to another town inside Syria that might seem safer.
It might seem safer. Even, you know, that town might have been gotten shelled earlier, but now there's nothing going on. They really try to do what they can to stay inside, because everybody has family, everybody has roots. And the Syrian people, they love their country. They don't want to leave the country. Why should they leave the country? All they were asking for really was freedom and to live in their country, not we want to go somewhere else.
So to this point about, again, root causes of why so many people are fleeing, even though, as Nadia keeps, you know, reminding us, people don't want to leave. Here's a little clip from U.S. Senator and GOP presidential candidate Lindsey Graham last week on the Syrian refugee crisis, talking about, you know, focusing on some of the core problems. Graham was speaking at a Pints and Politics event in Concord with Dean Spiliotis on WKXL last week.
So here's the problem. If you don't get ahead of this, Jordan and Lebanon are going to collapse. And there are 30 million people in Syria. This is a tip of the iceberg, so I am begging the president and Republicans running for president to understand that if you don't get in on the ground and destroy ISIL and counteract what Russia is doing with Assad, you're going to be overwhelmed, not just in Syria, but Jordan and Lebanon are at risk, and the whole region is going to collapse.
Again, that's U.S. Senator and Republican presidential candidate Lindsey Graham speaking with Dean Spiliotis last week. Let's go back to our callers. Steve joins us from where? Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of comments and concerns regarding the Syrian refugees. Okay, this country is in $17 trillion in debt, all right? This is not a U.S. issue. It's not a U.S. problem. However, it seems like a lot of liberals and liberal politicians are making it a U.S. problem because it's going to, once again, burden the taxpayer, okay? Who's going to pay for all of these refugees to come over here? I mean, Obama administration right now is saying 10,000. Okay, it's probably not an accurate number. It seems to me like the only two countries out there right now that have any common sense with regard to this, which basically amounts to an invasion, is Hungary and Israel, which are denying access by these people. All right, we have homeless U.S. veterans in this country who have been ignored. Okay, they can't get services, can't get jobs.
But at the same time, you know, we have, you know, refugees that, you know, want to come to this country, okay? And apparently, like, once again, by liberals, are being welcomed here. And, you know,
and who's going to pay for it, Steve, is
exactly,
what you're saying. We've
ridiculous.
Got problems at home.
Okay. Thank and you. The secondary, yeah. secondary issue with it is when these people come here, okay, the premise behind it is that they assimilate to this culture, okay? I live just outside of Concord in Ware, New Hampshire. When I go through Concord, to me, it looks like a third world country when I'm driving down Loudoun Road. They do not assimilate to our culture, okay? They create their own.
Well, Steve, thank you for calling in. And to the point about this is not a U.S. problem. And by the way, you know, we do have lots of problems here ourselves. Anita Fabos, what do you think? Put this in the broader context of the refugee migrations that you've been looking at.
Well, if you do look back in history, you see not only the contributions and resources that people who come originally as refugees bring to the country and build our societies with their industriousness and with their, you know, educational backgrounds and so forth. I mean, my father was a Hungarian refugee, and he contributed quite a lot to this country with his work and as a university professor. And there are many, many refugees who are now well-established and integrated and secure American citizens. I think that some things that the other callers have said about the fear of the unknown, I think we can all agree that change is scary and that there are social services that are stretched thin enough as it is. But I do think keeping the attention on the longer term is important and will be important going forward. And and furthermore, I think that it's pretty scary to be a refugee and to face all of the changes that are coming in your life and having to make a new home and a new place and figuring all of that out for your families, I think is a fearful experience as well.
Well, and Steve talks a bit about this on the U.S. scale. Amy saying that, you know, we've got $8 trillion in debt. It's not a U.S. problem. Here's a Facebook comment from Jeremy, who puts this more into New Hampshire context. Jeremy says, I agree the United States is obligated to help out during a crisis, but he says, I question the wisdom of bringing a lot of refugees to a small state like New Hampshire, where even a small number of people will have a rather large impact. Jeremy says, jobs and resources are already scarce in the state. Perhaps it would be a better idea to bring them into a larger state, where the impact of a couple hundred or even a couple dozen people won't be felt as deeply. Jeremy says bigger states should be stepping up to the task. What do you think about this broad argument, Amy, that, you know, we've got enough of our own homegrown problems?
I think sometimes we get caught in the trap of framing this as an either-or conversation when really it's a both-and conversation. And I think sometimes we forget or we're caught in the trap that we think of the economy as a pie where if we take a piece out of it, somebody's not going to get their piece, when actually it's more like a membership organization. So the more people that are participating, the more the economy can expand. And we've seen that in New Hampshire. Immigration and by default, immigrants and refugees help make up for labor shortages and help with vast contributions to their new communities.
Give us an example of some of the people that you've worked with, Amy, that represent that instead of a slice of pie, it's a membership organization.
Sure. So I'm recalling a Bhutanese man who was resettled a few years ago who was so incredibly grateful for his opportunity to start his life over again that when he was asked, what does USA mean to you? He said, you start again, that you... you are able to build your life again. You get a job. You start paying taxes. You start contributing to community. Many refugees are volunteers. They help at social service organizations. They make contributions to social service organizations. So I think that they have embraced their new communities, and they're not trying to detract from the community.
Nadia, let's hear from you, too. Again, our caller talked about, you know, homegrown problems, and this is not a U.S. problem.
Well, I think
it's too much money.
We sort of got that covered. There's something I was reminded of with the Bhutanese story that Amy just shared, and that is that we have an orphan sponsorship program, and very movingly, we have refugees that arrive here and that can barely pay their bills, and they decide to take out $50 a month to sponsor a Syrian orphan inside Syria. People, they care at the other side. And at the same time, they work here and they want to make a contribution. So they want to still help with a problem and be U.S. citizens that contribute to the community that they live in. So there are always people at the other end. Definitely, the world is so small these days that we cannot ignore what's happening around the globe.
You know, I wonder what's next for your organization, Nadia. Relatively new, New Day Syria, again, working, as you told us, on the ground with women and children in, if not in Syria, in the region. At some point, do you shift to helping Syrian refugees who might be resettled in this country? I mean, I know it's still so early, but...
Well, our focus is inside Syria, both with immediate urgent aid programs and also with self-sustainable programs and orphan programs, as well as in Turkey with empowerment and aid with dignity. I'm actually not planning on us going into the local refugee situation here in the U.S. just because there's so much work to be done inside Syria and in Turkey right now for mothers.
Are you hearing from people who say, turn your attention to
daily,
this?
Daily, definitely.
Really?
But it's who else is focusing on the mother in particular in Turkey and inside Syria? It's very few organizations. So that's where our focus is.
And even with all the attention on the refugees coming into Europe and
even
so forth,
you're saying the numbers are small and these mothers, they want to go back and they need to go back empowered and with dignity.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being here. Nadia, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Nadia Alawa, founder and president of New Day Syria, a local nonprofit that, as she said, focuses on help with dignity to Syria's mothers and children. Anita Fabos, great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Anita Fabos, Associate Professor of International Development at Clark University with research focused on refugees and forced migrants. And Amy Marshallden, thank you also for your time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Amy Marshallden, Director of Services for New Americans at Accentria Care Alliance. This is The Exchange on NHPR.